Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. You are in for a real intelligence briefing from a real intelligence professional in the course of this very special hour of Secure Freedom Radio. Our guest for this time is Stephen Coughlin, retired major in the United States Army who specialized in intelligence during his time in uniform. He was called to active duty after 9/11 to serve on the Joint Chiefs of Staff as their duty expert on the threat we faced at the time. He helped, through his intensive research and extraordinarily important briefings and writings, help not only those in uniform, but an awful lot of the rest of us understand that what we were specifically confronting was an ideological force. He thought it best described as Sharia. And his subsequent teachings, writings, and, well, as I say, his education of so many others contributed materially to a book I'm very proud of at the Center for Security Policy Press entitled Sharia, The Threat to America. This is one of a number of very important works that he has authored, including Catastrophic Failure, Blindfolding America in the Face of Jihad, Bridge Building to Nowhere, the Catholic Church's Case Study in Interfaith Delusion, and a very important paper entitled Re-Remembering the Misremembered Left, the Left's Strategy and Tactics to Transform America. We're going to talk about all of that and more in the course of this program. I want to thank Steve Coughlin for not only his friendship and mentoring over the years, but this incredible continuing contribution to the public awareness and hopefully preparation to address the myriad threats that you've talked about in what I think of as the red-green axis, the radical left on the one hand, the Sharia supremacists on the other. And I want to thank you for taking an hour to talk us through all of this today. Steve, you are currently the president and founder of Unconstrained Analytics, and people can find a lot of what we're going to be talking about on your page there, unconstrainedanalytics.org. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, Steve Coughlin. Good to have you here. It's a pleasure to have you, and it's important that we address the sources of this grimness, and most especially, Steve, to tap your considerable intellectual mastery of so many of these subjects so as to figure out how to respond appropriately. Let's start with, if we may, in this relatively brief first segment, just a quick sort of level setting on political warfare. It's something, as I say, you've studied closely. How would you characterize it and the degree to which forces that have been part and parcel of its practice over, well, now centuries, are in evidence in our own country at the moment?
Well, I'm going to give you an answer right now that we might spend a lot of time through the course of the program referring back to unpack. As we see it today, political warfare is the Maoist insurgency model, and it's a variation of the model Chairman Mao used in his Long March. This is very important because in 1971, a leading Marxist in the United States, a man named Herbert Marcuse, said that the American left was joining the Long March program of Mao, so that we know that the left is engaged in political warfare. Now, the first $200 word is counterstate, and counterstate bears an awful lot of similarity with the term deep state that's popular in the media, but there's a real term, counterstate. And what Marcuse said was they would use the universities as the initial counter state in which to bring people in and train them. And they would then send people out into government. They would send people out into industry. They would send people out into media and education. And that's, what, 50 years ago. So what we see is through that process, this has happened. Now, the second part of what is political warfare, and this is the part people pretend when they say they get it, and I'm saying it is completely unlike what you're, how we understand it, is that political warfare executes through narratives, and its command and control is through narratives. So you literally have to stop thinking in terms of the way the average person does, line and block chart, where you have head, president, vice president, distribution, and understand everything is encoded in the narratives they use. And that process of commanding the narratives is what Mao called mass line development. So what you're seeing right now is they've been putting out narratives that cause people. You're seeing some troops in the out in the field. You're seeing some generals in the Air Force, and then all of a sudden, then colonels in the Air Force, and all of a sudden, command sergeant majors signaling that they're backing. They're not backing Trump on this. They're backing the riots. It's because there's a narrative that they're following, and as that narrative comes through, you will obey it or you will be punished. Now, of course, this all sounds, you know, you've been informed where we talk about this, and it seems so cloudy and ethereal. But right now, people are literally being brutalized on the street for obeying this, those command narratives. And the number one command narrative is political warfare. I mean, is political correctness. Let me make this clear, like the republic depends on it. Political warfare is the enforcement mechanism to the postmodern narrative that executes cultural Marxism. To obey politically correct standards is to put the neo-Marxist narrative ahead in priority and precedence of the Constitution, so that every time you hear a politician say, we're going to enforce the Constitution, we're going to obey this legislation, we're going to look at the bill, and we're going to do whatever, but we have to be politically correct, that instantly tells you that person is obeying the Marxist standard because he's afraid of the mass line punishment he'll receive. And what we're seeing right now is people are actually being mugged in the street by this. And that was in the works from the day political correctness started.
That's an extraordinarily rich, you know, sort of opening salvo. And we will drill down on elements of it throughout the program, Stephen Coughlin. I do want to just say that what you have connected here in terms of some very important dots is the ideological pedigree, really, of Maoism, Marxism, cultural Marxism, the march through the institutions, the evolution and promulgation of political correctness as a vehicle for forcing conformity with sort of the political warfare strategy of those radical leftist elements. And all of those are now in play on the streets, as you say, of the United States of America. And we'll be talking more with Stephen Coughlin about what that means in practice and what we had best be doing about it in the following three segments straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are speaking for this full hour with Stephen Coughlin, a remarkable resource, a man that I'm privileged to call a friend as well as a colleague, and very proud to be able to present to you all as one of the great thinkers and most serious and I think most accurate analysts of the challenges that we're facing as a country from basically the enemy within. And he, like me and countless others, swore an oath to defend our Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. He took that oath when he served in the United States Army, rising to the rank of major. He is today still fulfilling that oath of office at Unconstrained Analytics. And let me ask you, Steve Coughlin, if you would, just a little bit of again, that lineage on the cultural Marxists, because I think it is important to our understanding of who we're up against now as well.
Well, I think for the first time in a very long time, people are seeing the full force of the left in America deployed for the destruction of America. And it's very important that the leading Gramsci Marxist in 1968 branded the Gramsci School participants in the Long March through the institutions. Marcuse in the United States is one of the founding members of the Frankfurt School. So when you heard the Gramsci Marxist in Europe, the Frankfurt School predominantly in Germany and in the United States, say they were joining the Long March, that became the only game in town to watch. And the only way to understand them is according to their rule book. And if you're not on their rule book, you will always be a dollar short and a day late, always catching up, which is exactly what we're seeing right now.
Right. We're trying to catch up, and it's a challenge because it's coming at us so forcefully now. And Steve, I guess what you have really been documenting, among other things, through this incredible work that you did entitled Re-Remembering the Misremembered Left, which people can find on your website for free at unconstrainedanalytics.org, is the degree to which these sorts of intellectual doctrines and rule book, as you say, have in fact been honed and weaponized and put into place and are now being activated. And I want to talk with you in this block about an individual that I know you've been following closely. You've been warning about for quite some time. You have written about, in fact, in one of your other papers at unconstrainedanalytics.org, namely the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota, former Congressman Keith Ellison. Tell us a bit about his background and the role that you believe he is now playing, and his state, as a result, is now playing in this counter-state movement.
Well, it's very interesting that a person who was elected, and the first thing he did was associate with members of CARE, a Muslim Brother organization aligned with Hamas.
Council on American Islamic Relations, of course.
Of course. Is give those cries, goes to Congress, becomes the number two Democrat in Congress, the number two Democrat in the party, and all of a sudden leaves his job to be run for the Attorney General of Minnesota. Well, that should cause people to say, what's that? So he's in position. In 2018, he posts a Twitter of him endorsing Antifa. Of course, Antifa is the violent wing of the Marxist Party, of the Communist Party. And in fact, Antifa was originally formed in 1932 by the Soviet-run Comintern, Communist International, in 1932. And it was stood up in America in 1934 or 35 as the American League Against War and Fascism. They've been here that long. And so when all of a sudden you see next to him endorsing Antifa, that tells you that the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota is going to be running his decision through what is appropriate for Antifa. And for people who are not following this, his son, who's a city council member in Minneapolis, just declared his affiliation with Antifa. Then about a little while ago, maybe 10 days or so ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, he came out and endorsed, put out a video endorsing, and CARE advertises CARE. And they were using the language of CARE, of the Muslim Brotherhood, to explain what they were, that they're a human rights organization. Well, of course, the Brotherhood and the left use what I'll call signaling language. If we say coded language, everybody thinks that they're hiding it from everybody. They're not. It's just that you have to make a decision to understand what they mean according to their rule book. So when he says he's endorsing CARE as the Islamic community's number one civil rights group, you instantly have to know, like, the republic depends on it, that for an Islamic organization, civil rights is human rights, and human rights is exclusively defined as Sharia law, as stated in a UN document submitted to the United Nations in 1991 called the Cairo Declaration on Human Rights in Islam, unconditionally stating when a Muslim says human rights, and in America that encompasses civil rights, they mean nothing but Sharia law. So here you have Keith Ellison, the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota, and he is the point where what a lot of people call the Red-Green Alliance, so I'm okay with that. I cringe at it only because I think we underestimate how powerful that is. We peg it at the knee level, and it goes much higher on the pyramid. So here it is. Ellison is the personification of that alliance put in place to execute something.
And when you say personification, it's because he is personally both a very pedigreed leftist, the chairman in the House of Representatives for a time of the Progressive Caucus, the radical left wing in the Democratic Caucus, and a practicing, well, I guess Sharia supremacist is the way I would characterize it, not just a Muslim, but a champion of Sharia as well. And as you said, Steve Coughlin, he is the chief law enforcement officer of the state of Minnesota. So tell us a little bit about your paper that is now available at unconstrainedanalytics.org/blog about Minnesota becoming a counter state. What role has he played in that, and what does it mean, and how is it fitting into what we're watching play out on the streets of Minneapolis and St. Paul, among other places now?
Well, I want you to recall, I'm going to figure out how to answer your question. I want you to recall that the political warfare narrative executes, including command and control, through narratives. So that when these things happen and you saw the mayor of Minneapolis send code language, that he accepts that there's a right rioting. I think the code language for this has been, among other things, rioting is the voice of the oppressed. He was signaling to these people free reign. Okay, then when you saw the Attorney General say the same thing, the state of Minnesota was on notice that the state of Minnesota, the Attorney General, was signaling that. And then when you heard the governor say that, you knew that the citizens of Minnesota were going to be exposed to violence that the state was not going to intervene in. Now, I will admit to being frustrated, because if you understand political warfare, it doesn't get clearer than this. And the opaqueness by which most people are hearing this on your radio show is opaque because they want to translate it into their own. It's like you take a foreign language, and the first couple months that you're in a foreign country, you are translated into your language before you say it. But you're really not moving until you say it on the fly. And so what you see with Keith Ellison, to bring back to your original question, is he is in place. So I see these things come up, the CARE thing, and that's when I realized, let me add one other piece to this. At the same time, we see the COVID narrative start to wear down. And I'm qualifying that as where some of these far-left narratives were being implemented and imposed on people. You saw what's called provocatia in Russian. It's agitation and provocation, where they were starting to gin up, poke people, get people angry, and create incidences on the street, that can inflame. And if you do enough of them somewhere, there will be an overreaction, and they got one in Minneapolis.
That being the incident involving this police officer and the knee on the neck of this poor man who was arresting.
The police officer on the street. Now, because we don't understand how political warfare goes, our way of explaining it is, well, this was a setup. And of course, you sound like you're overstating the argument. You can't prove that it was ever a setup, that, the police were going to do this and this was going to happen. Well, and that's why people have to understand how mass lying narratives work. If you start poking enough places somewhere, eventually you'll get that response. And then you will have a spring-loaded series of responses to bootstrap up first Black Lives Matter and then Antifa to a full-blown riot. So, where you hear people saying it's, for example, a peaceful demonstration that was hijacked by radicals, not on a political warfare scenario. Everything that was happening was about getting it to violent people on the street.
And Steve, you have documented, I think, in your new paper on this counterstate business in Minnesota, that there were other incidents that might have been seized upon that was sort of creating a bit of the environment for this particular one to become the flashpoint. But the preparations, I guess is what I'm getting at, the preparations that have been underway now for some time under the influence, if not the direct auspices of Keith Ellison, for the kind of mayhem that has been taking place of late is something that, again, is documentable, that Keith Ellison, as the chief law enforcement officer of the state, has not only been signaling that he's good with rioting in opposition to this particular incident, but that he has been essentially laying the groundwork for this. He and his comrades, if I can use that expression, have been laying the groundwork for this kind of reaction, counterstate, as you call it, for some time. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I'd like to point to the fact that in January, Soros came out and said it was coming, and he reiterated that in February. He was very clear about it.
George Soros, of course, being a financier of the radical left, who has stated, I think, something to the effect of it would be his highest accomplishment in life or greatest ambition in life or something to that effect to destroy the United States of America. He's hard at it, folks, and he's working with people like Keith Ellison and others in the Red-Green Axis, and we're going to talk more about their cumulative effects and what we need to do about it with Steve Coughlin straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Stephen Coughlin of Unconstrained Analytics, a tremendous resource on so much of the challenges that we're facing, particularly from the enemy within. And Steve, I just want to come back to something that you were talking about before. Keith Ellison, Attorney General of Minnesota, has been instrumental to some of the counterstate buildup that we've been now exposed to in terms of its ambitions and its malevolence. Just close up with us, if you would, on the role he's playing today and its implications, not just for Minnesota, but for all of us.
Absolutely. And I want to go back to some political warfare terms. When we say counterstate, it means state within a state. And I'm sure you have people listening and they're kind of looking at where's the tinfoil for that guy to put on his hat. This is classical counterinsurgency warfare, that you have the state within a state. There's nothing unique about what I'm saying. What is so strange is in the American political world, we have no language to explain it when it happens to us. And we have no experience of it ever happening to us in the way we're seeing it. But if we were evaluating a foreign country the way if we were evaluating what's going on in America as if it were a foreign country, we would say this is a full-on insurgency. They're looking to topple the regime. They're imposing mass lying narratives. And so long as the other side doesn't see it, the republic may fall. And in that regard, the very second someone like Ellison, who is the personification of the left and the Islamic movement, became the attorney general, that's when it became reasonable to think that, and stepping down from a very senior position in Washington, that's when from a political warfare analysis you would say, if the plan goes according to schedule for them, it's going to start in Minnesota. There, it's there because the Attorney General of Minnesota is the living personification of someone who said, we are going to see events through Antifa violence and Muslim Brotherhood topple the regime narratives. So it's in that regard that you go to someone like George Soros, who has been funding both sides of this equation for some time.
Both sides, meaning the red and the green, the hard left and the Islamists.
Red and the green, and especially the red. And you see how it has been trickling down in these organizations, so that when you see prominent Democrats contribute money to Antifa, I can't say it without stamping my feet or screaming, which I'm not going to do. When a prominent Democrat contributes money to Antifa, they're contributing money to an organization that is under foreign influence, that is committed to the violent overthrow of the America and to the extermination of white males. Half the placards Antifa has says that you should kill all fascists. Others say all white men are fascists. I mean, it's actually genocidal when you think about it. And, you know, we really need to push this forward. So what you have is a situation where on the left side, you have the counterstate goes as high as everybody you're seeing line up with Antifa. And when these generals coming out of the Pentagon are signaling their support for their narratives, people need to be very careful. They need to take a very sober view of what they're seeing in that, because that's during the middle of a crisis that one side wants to turn into a revolution.
Let me just interrupt you, because I have not seen that kind of information coming out of general officers in the Pentagon. Can you point to something in the way of a specific example?
Well, I could. I would have to turn on my Twitter, and I could get that sent to you. But yes, a Air Force general, then a brigade commander, and then a NCO, and then somebody just sent me this morning. I'm opening my mail. Sent me today's early bird, which is the Department of Defense. Inside news system, just listing off all the generals coming and saying something that's signaling where they're at.
And where they're at means that they are expressing affinity for or solidarity with the protesters. Is that the idea? And you're reading that as not just the peaceable, you know, folks who are understandably infuriated by this injustice that was perpetrated by this police officer, but the people who are, you know, now translating their protests into political warfare instruments against the state.
Absolutely. You know, it's very important that I have not met anybody who's even suggested that the police officers involved in that killing shouldn't be arrested and brought to justice. And I don't think there was ever a moment where that is in doubt. But in terms of declaring this a fascist organization, it needs to be pointed out that the mayor of Minneapolis is a far-left mayor, the attorney general we're talking about is very far-left, and the governor of Minnesota is very far-left. And it turns out that the police forces that are the most violent are the ones that kind of, in the country, fit that paradigm. And, of course, the narrative also coming out right now, and it's being heavy-handed, is the Pentagon itself is saying, well, we see white supremacists involved in this work. And I think people should understand, that is just nonsense. It's outrageously nonsense.
Well, it's a narrative, is what it is. It's designed to obscure the true intentions and the successful execution of this pre-planned strategy, Stephen Coughlin, and thereby enable its future success. Steve, we can talk about so much of this at much greater length than we have time for today. Let me just turn to something that you touched on a moment ago. You said that Antifa had its roots in the Soviet Comintern back in the early 1930s. You alluded to the fact that it still has foreign influence. What foreign influence are you speaking of? And can you describe how that foreign influence is perhaps now, if not actually instigating what's going on in the streets of America with these riots and so on? It certainly is exploiting it.
Well, I would say that the two dominant foreign ideological sources are coming from the European Union, and that would include groups like Soros and people like him. And you could say they're the key ideological drivers. But then I would say that on the side where you see stuff more physically, China. Okay, I mean, I don't know what role China is playing in this, but it needs to be said that this came at a very well-timed period for them, where the Trump administration was powering down on them on certain policies, and they needed something to go on as they cracked down brutally in Hong Kong. And so there is the sense that because this is a mass line movement, and those movements are predominantly international, okay, we need to understand that there are international drivers to what's happening here, and that has to be figured into the equation. Now, I would take a step back and point out that just like you separate the brutal killing of a black man on the street in Minneapolis from the narratives used to drive a revolution, I think we have to understand that the dominant narrative being used by the left is something called discourse theory, which created by a man named Habermas of the Frankfurt School. The only reason I'm bringing this up and going into detail is because that narrative was imposed as part of the dominant narrative on COVID. So that, you know, and as we looked at the COVID thing, what started to emerge is the fact that once you go one step above what's going on with the COVID crisis itself, there are either international organizations or very prominent foundations who seem to have absolute dominance in the conduct of what's going on in the COVID narrative, and China is absolutely dominant. And so you could see that we can't quite put our finger on what role they're playing, but you know, if you read Unrestricted Warfare, right at the beginning of that whole document, Unrestricted Warfare being a document written by two colonels, okay, and the People's Liberation Army at their war college said in 1999 that they believed the United States was completely incapable of understanding political warfare. That was their Achilles heel, that Al-Qaeda would join in on that, and they did. And part of what they said was part of the political warfare process was that they would use things like pandemics to stand up their political warfare efforts against the United States. It's right in the book from 1999.
So, Steve, let me just pause. We know, both through, you know, the intellectual lineage from Mao and the Mass Line Movement and, well, People's War, the importance of political warfare and the various instruments for advancing it, including rioting in the streets and pandemics and, oh, economic warfare and so much more, all of which is, as you say, laid out impressively in this book, Unrestricted Warfare, that China has been positioned to do exactly what has been done to us for quite some time. What we may not be able to demonstrate in absolutely indisputable terms at the moment is that they unleashed the virus deliberately. They certainly deliberately acted to ensure that it got here. That's unquestioned, I guess, but deliberately out of a laboratory that they, you know, developed it in for the purposes of taking us down, any more than we can demonstrate at the moment that they are actively involved in the instigating of this counter-state insurgency in our country. But having said that, and I think we should leave it that that remains to be determined in both cases, but having said that, Steve Coughlin, there is simply no disputing that they are taking maximum advantage of both the pandemic that came out of China and the counterstate insurgency operations that intellectually flowed from Mao's practices as teaching. Steve, we have to pause. We're going to come right back. When we do, we're going to visit further with Steve about what do we do, confronted as we are now by these various threats, to ensure that we survive the Republic and our freedoms and our survival indeed as a people. That and much more with Stephen Coughlin of Unconstrained Analytics right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. This is the fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily rich, deeply troubling, but extremely timely conversation with one of the best thinkers in our country about political warfare, the people who wage it against us, and what we are now witnessing in the way of its practice at their hands across America. His name is Stephen Coughlin. He is an intelligence professional in the United States Army, now retired, and the president and founder of an extraordinarily valuable not-for-profit called Unconstrained Analytics. You can find out much more about its work and Steve Coughlin's great writings there at unconstrainedanalytics.org. And also, we're very proud to say we've published a couple of his books at the Center for Security Policy Press, and you can download those as well at securefreedom.org. So, Steve, just a further clarification, if you have any, on China's role in what we're facing at the moment.
I think, you know, the whole point you're making is we can't say that what they're doing, but we know there's something going on because they're part of that international narrative. And I put it this way, and I did put, you know, I wrote very early on something called calling for a red team on COVID to start looking at the non-specific virus-related aspects of how COVID was rolling forward, raising China. And I put it like this: you're in a huge crater that only certain types of bombs can make a blast that big. And you know there's only a couple places or countries that can make a blast that big. So the question in that kind of scenario where you know something very bad has happened, you know very few people can do it, and you know even fewer have it written into their doctrine, that if China was to execute the political warfare regime that we're talking about, if Al-Qaeda was to execute the regime they talk about, wouldn't it look like this? And if you say yes, then you have to start analyzing as if it's true, even if it's just to prove that it's not. So the very fact that people are holding back until there's evidence that it is true is, from a political warfare point of view, is that they're going to give you the evidence after it doesn't matter that you have it. That it's so deadly. So here's the thing. This whole COVID thing happens, and Trump responds by printing. The printing presses on the dollar are just spinning off the machine. And what are you seeing reporting also? This is another aspect of political warfare, that they're getting to release their digital currency. And what's that digital currency going to do? It's going to directly attack the U.S. dollar. And everybody will have to start looking at it as if these are disjointed elements, when if you understood political warfare, and then China's expressly stated understanding of where they'll go with it, we should have had this on a whiteboard 15 years ago. And so I think that's how I would answer the question about what role China's having. It doesn't get any better than this. And then I will turn to the European Union, because I'm basically saying they carry the ideological stick. What I found out doing research on COVID was how many of our NATO allies, like Italy, are wanting to line up with the Chinese Silk Road policy, and they're effectively abandoning the United States as a NATO ally without saying it. Turkey, basically, we're very aware of what Turkey's doing.
They're gone.
Absolutely. And it's like we're defending institutions that the other side are hollowing out if they're not repurposing them to their advantage.
So, Steve, we could continue admiring the problem. I think you very helpfully illuminated its magnitude and its implications. Let's take the remaining couple of minutes we have to just talk about what should we be doing now in light of all of this with respect to our domestic enemies, and I use that term advisedly, as well as our foreign ones.
Well, I think the first thing I would do, and I would really scream at our side about this, we need to be really concerned about the foreign influence here. Okay? We can clearly see it. Now stop. Everything we're seeing is completely domestic and doesn't depend on foreign influence for this phase of the operation. So there's a sense in which if your eyes are looking abroad at the immediate situation, they're already looking past what's going on. I think what has to happen is we have to get our people to say, stop. You are going down a road that the other side has scripted you on. You've adopted their narrative of hijack. By the way, when everybody's saying it's hijacked, that cuts off your ability to even conduct political warfare analysis of what's happened. And so I would create red teams that are basically saying, let's do this as if the political warfare model is accurate, because it is. It's the only game in town to address this. And let's start getting people together to start putting this together. We need to tell the president that he needs to get a grip on this, because I think the Republic is an imminent risk right now.
What does that mean as a practical matter? It means we're going to have to wage political warfare back at the people perpetrating it against us? Does it mean putting troops in the streets to shut down these riots? Does it mean, you know, suspending civil liberties? I mean, what specifically are you counseling, if you had the presidency here as well as our audiences, Steve Coughlin, that be done at this moment?
I think the president has to take immediate action to tell people in the national security apparatus to suspend communications about what they're doing, that this is the United States of America. He's the president and the commander-in-chief, and they need to understand that. And he needs to make it clear it won't be tolerated. I think certain actions need to be taken.
And with regard to that, you're talking about specifically these people popping off about what their personal views are on the merits of, you know, the protests or the opposition being expressed to our government.
Absolutely, because we look at it and we roll our eyes. What does that general know? But I will tell you, in the political warfare world, that's taken as signaling. That's taken as signaling. Now, it would be wrong of me to say that means that these guys are batting for the other team, because we don't know. And the other point that's very important is, if you have a Republican who uses that narrative, like Nikki Haley, when she does that, she's exposing herself as a controlled opposition. And she's also showing that this is that she is going to fold to this narrative. So I think people really I think it's imminently important that we take the actions to get control of the street, fully understanding that the left's next move, their next move is to directly dependent on an overreaction on our side to escalate it. They're not getting that. That's why they're talking about the white races. But we have to understand that when you see these signalings, that our side says, well, you know, you can't know that's true. And my point would be, because you don't understand how it works. So I would say this. We wrote a 170-page manual, Re-Remembering the Misremembered Left, to explain the strategic design that will make this work. Last November, I put out Warning on Racism to explain that they're going to use the Marxist concept of racism to commandeer this election cycle. It was written in November, so it's documented. And from that, I was socializing the paper on Ellison before the Minneapolis event actually happened. So we are exactly on target and on schedule with what we said was going to happen, where everyone else on our side is responding to what happened last week.
We've got to get ahead of this. We've got to be understanding where they're going next and beat them to the punch. And I guess, Steve Coughlin, what you're saying based on these various writings is you have had an appreciation of the forces at work here that is very prescient, to say the least, and needs to be factored into the kinds of policies and the kinds of countervailing activities that will enable us to restore order, yes, but also, more to the point, to get on the forward foot rather than the back one on the political warfare threat we're facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. And I just want to say, I salute you for the clarity with which you have figured these things out over so many years, Steve Coughlin. You have often been assailed for having done so, for reasons I'm very familiar with, mostly having figured things out before it becomes conventional wisdom. And oftentimes that's meant you're hectored for having done so. You're vilified. You're, you know, the tin hat guy and so on, the tinfoil hat guy. The same basic point applies, though, that this record is one that I believe demands attention from the president on down, and that the hour is extraordinarily late to take counsel from you and to take the sorts of corrective actions that you're calling for. So with that, my friend, we are hard out of time, but I look forward to resuming this conversation with you, because we've got much more to talk about in this domain. And also, I want to visit with you about something else you've been focused on as well, and that is, as a practicing Catholic, what the Pope Francis is up to that is playing into some of these same forces and scenarios. All of this is vital work. Thank you for what you do at unconstrainedanalytics.org. Steve Coughlin, please, folks, check it out and support that work. I'm sure there's a way to donate there at that page. Please do so. Steve, come back to us soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.